Well, I do want to say it's a wonderful opportunity to be here, and I do want to encourage you too, just to know that there's about a billion Christians around the world who are meeting around about this time, in all kinds of places, all over the globe, some in far-flung corners. I mean, Antarctica is only a short swim from here, isn't it? Okay. And then there are other Christians who are meeting in what we might regard from a human point of view as the very centres of political, economic and military power. All over the world, Christians are remembering the cross. It's an amazing thing if you think about it. So you need to know there's about a billion of us. Is that ringing back? Can you hear that? Should I step back or something? Or okay, we're all good. Thank you so much. And especially, you know, when we think about what's just happened in the last few days in Christchurch. Anyone been there? Christchurch at all? Yeah, been there a few times. As if an earthquake's not enough. Oh, my goodness. It's just been challenging, and people are trying to process this. And I don't know if you've noticed, but a number of folk have talked about all decent people being shocked by this and a sense of compassion. Can I just say, you want to be encouraged by that? My field, I spend a lot of time thinking about the ancient world, which is where the gospel began. No one in the ancient world would have spoken like that. No one. And certainly not about people who are not part of your group. So I just want you to understand this. Even though all over the Western world people are saying we're not Christian, that's just a load of old cobblers, actually. That's a technical term from a professor. Right? You can't even live in the modern world without being fundamentally Christian. And I'm not just talking about ethics. That's a whole other topic area. But I just want to point out that in the middle of this really difficult time, you should take some encouragement. It's actually the cross of Jesus that has taught us to have compassion on people who are not part of our group. Yeah, right. So right there, you can actually see the Lordship of Jesus, even if people don't own it. Yeah. I'm not criticizing them for that. But there's also a troubling element to this. And that is, confronted with the situation, people try to come up with some explanation, don't we? And unfortunately, it's part of human nature to want to demonize other people. You ever notice that? It's part of that. They're not in my group, therefore, right? And I think what worries me is we can talk about a common humanity, but when we start processing, right, or even if we look at what's going on with the guy who committed this terrible atrocity, he seems to have this view that because a few Muslims are bad, everyone's bad, all Muslims are bad, and he just tribalizes them, kind of an identity politics. Right? He just does that. And what worries me is I see some very intelligent people doing exactly that to him. Yes. Right? That he now represents everyone who kind of might have hesitations about certain things in politics or whatever. And I just don't think that's helpful, folks. And it's happening all over the world. A friend of mine just came back from New York, and they were stunned at the level of uncivil and virulent language as people divide over politics. And it's, you think, what in the world is going on here? And I think actually that this identity politics is part of the problem. And that's where I think the cross has an amazing thing to say to us. These kinds of tensions are not new. They've marked humanity for a very long time. And they were certainly present when Paul was preaching his gospel. You know, so the Roman Empire, which is where the gospel began for many of us, it has a veneer of unity, but underneath all kinds of social tensions. If you know something about the history, they would regularly erupt into murderous riots. I think the city of Antioch would have some of these, you know, every 10 years or so, right? The ancient world was like that. So can we go to the slide? I'm sorry about the text being so small here, and my apologies, but I can read it to you. So let's see how we go. So our text comes from Paul's letter to this fledgling Christian community in Corinth. And they too are dividing. Good thing it never happens in our churches, right? We never have groups of this identity, that identity. And what they're doing is basically dividing behind different leaders. And this is how Paul chooses to respond. Now just think about this. For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us, and now he's talking to a divided church, who are being saved, it is the power of God. We've sung a lot about power today. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. That's why I don't like being called a professor. kind of puts me in that group, right? And the discernment of the discerning, I will thwart. Where is... Now, we're Pentecostal, right? So I can speak loudly. Okay, good. I do preach in quite a few evangelical churches and have to tone things down a little. Not very successfully, but we try, right? Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? That means the lawyer. Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided instead, I'll add that word, through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs and Greeks desire wisdom, but we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who were called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength. We could just kind of stop and ponder that for the next hour, and I could just walk away and you'd get far more out of it than me speaking, I think. But can we just move to the next slide? And you see, none of these letters just don't drop out of the sky. And what's really helped me is to understand these are written to real communities, people just like you. They might have dressed differently, but, you know, Greek part of the world, okay? So these are real people living in real situations, and it helps to get a sense of that world. So Corinth, which you can see just here marked by that red dot, there's not much left of it now. But it was originally a Greek city and had a long and a proud history. It joined something called the Achaean League, which I don't expect any of you to know anything about, which is fine. It has nothing to do with salvation, so you're okay. But these are the Greeks fighting against the Romans. And in 146 BC, the city was destroyed by a consul called Lucius Mummius. Parents, please don't call your boys Mummius. That's probably not going to get them very well. And he put the entire adult male population to the sword. The women and children were sold into slavery. And he just reduced the city to ashes. And we don't know the population. Could have been 60,000 or more, right? And that was typical of the ancient world, right? That's just what you did. We're all up in arms because 49 people died in a mosque, right? No one in the ancient world would have batted an eyelid. That's just the way the world was. Now, you see, it's in such a brilliant location, right there at that kind of little point, so ships can travel, or at least come to one port, unload their cargo, save them going around the bottom. It's a stunning location, so it couldn't stay ruined for long. And Julius Caesar, remember him, Big Julie, right? He refounds the city about 100 years later as a Roman colony. And it's really important when you read 1 Corinthians, it might be in the Greek world, but it's actually a Roman colony, and that does change things. Now, no surprise, it quickly becomes a major commercial and trading center, flourished and rapidly became one of the great cities of the empire. So that's what we're talking about. A letter written to a group of Christians in one of the great cities of the Roman world. Right? Now, it happens to be remarkably cosmopolitan. Now, Paul wrote to the Philippians, which is also a Roman colony, but that's still basically pretty much Greek. He writes to the Colossians, but that's actually pretty Phrygian. Now, if you don't know who the Phrygians are, that's fine, no problem. But what makes Corinth different is every imaginable mix of people can be found there, and you can see this in the church. If you look at the names, there's Romans, there's Greeks, there's Jews, there's Orientals. It's a real mix reflecting the empire. It's one of the reasons why the letters of the Corinthians are just so great, because you're seeing Paul engage with this amazingly cosmopolitan and wealthy mix of people, and you get to see how the gospel speaks to that world, and it's stunning. We only have 35 minutes left or so I have to keep moving here, but spent a lot of time in Corinthians. Now, in the ancient world, wealth and dire poverty, just side by side, people are used to that. Anyone been to Brazil? Okay, if you go there, you'll have some experience of what that's like. That was common in the ancient world. Corinth was even worse. So if you want to talk about a disparity between really wealthy people and very poor people, and that's exactly what was in the church as well. Not surprising, I suppose. Now, as some people say, new wealth attracts people like dead meat attracts flies. So you can understand people are flocking to Corinth. That includes artisans, right? Because when you've got wealthy people like to buy art, artisans like to make it, so they're all flocking there to try and make a quick shekel. Enormous numbers of slaves, okay? The city is glistening with new marble, all kinds of folk, but fiercely independent, as such new cities tend to be. And guess what characterizes the church? You got it, fiercely independent. Funny that, isn't it? You don't stop being Australian or whatever just because you start going to church. Right? And the thing is, we bring all that stuff with us. Some of it good, and some of us, well, maybe not so good. There are also people called philosophers, who are more like educators. They want to make money, so guess where they come? Right? And they're selling their wares as well. So you've got all kinds of people like that. And it's also what you would call very religious. Now, I just need to say something here. No one in the ancient world thought they were practicing religion. Now, if you grew up in a Pentecostal home like I did, my mum and dad would say, Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship. And they're dead right, that's true. But that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, no one in the ancient world ever thought they were doing religion. They were just being Roman. They were just being Greek. They were just being Jewish. You couldn't separate that from who they were. And it's a modern conceit to think that you can be Australian and you can choose to be religious or not. No one in the ancient world thought like that. And certainly no Christians did. Yeah. That's another conversation. But I really encourage people, don't call Christianity religion, because that means we can compartmentalize it and keep it over here. No, it's not. It's a way of being in the world, and it claims everything. You don't get to be a bit Roman. You don't get to be a bit Greek. You're either Greek or Roman, and that's how they understand following Jesus, right? It's a whole world thing. Now, they had 26 different shrines and temples in this city. Why? Because everyone brings their practices along with them. Cosmopolitan city, it's all going on. Now, into this world, marked by these huge disparities on the basis of race, status, gender, if you like, Paul arrives around about 50 AD. So it's just over 100 years after the city was refounded. He stays for some 18 months and he leaves behind a new temple to the one true God. But it's a temple built of people. Yeah. All right? Now, anyone heard of Eugene Peterson? Great. Okay, so my one claim to fame is that he used to be a colleague. I was a colleague of his at Regent. Get to talk to Eugene. A very shy man, actually. Had lunch with him once. Hardly said a word. It was almost painful. But a great writer, okay? Eugene used to say, people tell lies. And they don't stop just because they become Christians. Right? Zing, I think is the right word. But if you've been around Christians long enough, you know that's true, don't you? Yeah. Right? Of course you do. And, you know, grow up. It's real, okay? Babies don't come by stalks, okay? So, yeah, there you go, right? So it's no surprise that in a city like this, rambunctious, new, fiercely independent, already defined by divisions, no surprise you find this starting to go on in the church. No surprise. Now, that needs to change, but people just bring this stuff with them. And what are they doing? They're dividing behind various leaders, ranking in terms of wisdom and power. And Paul's response is stunning. In fact, they're actually dividing behind him. And it's interesting, he just says, stop it. I didn't die for you. Right? What makes you think that I'm the guy you should be following? I've sometimes come across people who say, this is my church. Like, really? We can test that. We'll crucify you. If you come back, it's yours. If you don't, good riddance. Right? And where does this stuff come from? And I think this response was powerful back then, and it's really powerful right now as we consider the kinds of divisions going on in our culture. So next slide, please. Where does Paul start? And he starts with the cross. He starts with the cross. And I think sometimes we can forget that. If you don't mind me saying, we're growing up in the Pentecostal church, we love power, but we rarely associate the cross with power. I'm all for the power of the Holy Spirit, but let's not force apart the cross and the Holy Spirit. Paul's got some things to say about the power of God. Next slide. That's at work in the cross. Okay. So here's what he got. Next slide, please. Thank you. Sorry, it was a bit quick. And again, you'll just try and have to make sense of that text, and I'll try and read it out to you. So, For the Jewish people in the ancient world, or I should say the ancient world first, there's all kinds of divisions going on, and we've spoken about those. For the Jewish people, there were basically just two, right? And that was between Jews and Gentiles, because Jews alone knew the one true God, nobody else did. So that for them was the fundamental division. And it might come as a bit of a shock, but actually Christians do believe that there are some divisions in the world. And if Jesus is really who he is, then actually it does matter whether you follow him or not. It really does. Now, our culture doesn't like that. We're all pluralist. See what happens if you happen to follow Donald Trump or Bill Clinton and see how pluralist the world is not. Right? Okay. So we sometimes kid ourselves on that. But what Paul says now, and there's no love lost between Jews and Gentiles, by the way, but what Paul says is actually the cross has transformed all of that. Because of what happened in the cross, it's no longer all these different groups, or it's no longer Jews and Gentiles. Now, because of the cross, it's divided into those who are being saved and those who are perishing. And that's the division. Now, that's a bit hard to handle for some of us. But that's the reality that the cross has inaugurated. You're on one side or the other. You're either in the process of being destroyed, or you're in the process of being saved. Whoa. And he's saying this to a community of Christians who know Jesus but are dividing over different issues. Right? Now, why is he going to do that? Well, you see, it's really important when you're responding to a situation to start in the right place. Right? You would know that. Some of you are builders. You've got to start with the foundations. You'd be in trouble if you don't. Start in the wrong place. You can go all over the map and probably end up in the wrong area. So where we start is absolutely critical, and Paul wants to start with the cross. He says that's foundational. What happened in the cross has radically changed the world. And hear that language, being saved or being destroyed, as a term we use as academics called eschatological, right? If you can take injections and get cured after about a month. No? It sounds like some kind of disease, doesn't it? What it means is end time stuff, right? And Paul recognizes because of the cross, God is saying something about the destiny of all of creation. You're on one side or the other in all of this. Now, can I say, folks, when we began, our movement used to be very what we would call interested in the end days last time. Remember that? And I grant you some of it was a bit odd. Remember all those charts and stuff? And there were some very interesting ways of reading the Bible, to put it politely. And then it would sometimes be used as guilt manipulation. Remember that? Right? And some people even use it to build a career. I'm not sure that's what you should be doing with the gospel, personally. But anyway, so I understand those issues. We don't talk about this stuff anymore. I grew up every Sunday night singing about the second coming. Right? And we look forward to that because we didn't have much back then. Old theatre seats, weatherboard churches, suits that didn't fit properly, all wore suits back then. Now we have BMWs, surround sound televisions, and we don't sing about heaven anymore. What does that tell you? Right? But what worries me, folks, is when we're not talking about the end, we can lose perspective. And Paul's reminding us, no, actually, there is a day that's coming. You're going to be on one side or the other. Wow. Right? And he's saying to these Christians who are dividing, you're at real risk of losing your eternal destiny because of the basis on which you're making these divisions. Right? These people are dividing on the basis of what they think is wise and what they think is powerful. And he says, you need to make sure that your vision of wise and powerful is actually shaped by the cross, not by some other estimation. Right? It's got to reflect what God has done. It's pretty sobering, isn't it? He's warning them, if you keep up with this, judging people on those bases, when Christ turns up, you're done. People in the church. That's how serious this is. The choices they make now, the choices that I make now, means I'm either in the process of being saved or in the process of being destroyed. Right? It is. Now, how does Paul know this? Next slide, please. He knows this because God has always set his face against self-reliant human wisdom. Now, please understand, God is not against knowledge. Paul's a really sharp cookie. In fact, some French philosophers are now looking at him as one of the major voices that created the modern world. Paul's really sharp. Right? It's true God speaks through donkeys just once. Right? Now, you know, I'm not attacking people here, but, you know, it's important to know what you're talking about. The difference is we don't do it in a self-reliant and arrogant and autonomous way. Right? We want to learn how to think in keeping with the scriptures, have them tell us how we ought to think, and that's what Paul's doing. He cites Isaiah 9:14, which is a brilliant text because it's written to the people of God. It's Israel, and Israel's got some leaders, and they think they know what's going on. And the prophet says, no, you need to do this. Oh, come on, we're smarter, we're cool, we're sophisticated. We know how the real world works, right? We're going to do our own thing. And God says, really? Those decisions that seem so wise to you will end up destroying you. And that's what happened. And Paul quotes that text, warning Christians about relying on their own wisdom that's built on the values of the present passing age. Don't do that, he says. Next slide. So in this next slide, next text, Paul picks up on three great figures. I have photos of them all there, right? That represent the wisdom of the current world. The wise man, the intellectual, right? The philosopher. It's the kind of thing that the Greeks prided themselves in, right? Only what was rational. And by the way, you know, you hear people talk about only believe what's rational. It's just crazy. Utterly wrong. The world is not rational. If it was rational, heavier objects would fall faster than light ones, but they don't. That's why the Greeks never developed science. When people say, oh, I just want to be rational, I'm thinking, do you actually know what you're talking about there? Do you really know that? Because no, that's not the way of the world. The scribe, that's the Jewish side of things. He's the legal expert in the law. Paul was one of those. That's why he knew Jesus had to be under God's curse, because the scripture says, cursed is everyone who hangs upon a tree. And then the Corinthians, their guy, the debaters. If you're living in a world like Corinth, it's all about being able to persuade. And that's it with how you dress, right? Notice I turn up in a jacket, kind of add a little kind of dignity, right? Have your hair done properly, nicely suntanned, beautiful suit and tie. Never seen Christian missionaries do that, have you? Visiting evangelists, never come across like that, right? What's that grammar telling you? Does that look like Jesus? Did he play those kinds of games? Right? No. Because that's not transformative. That power is all about making me look better than you. And that's what leads to Christchurch. Right? I'm a cleverer person than you are. Therefore, I get to. I'm better looking than you are. Therefore, I get to exclude you. Right? And that's the very thing that brings all this disunity. And it's happening amongst God's people. And Paul has to remind them. For all of their wisdom, where do these guys stand now? None of them, for all that cleverness, ever could predict that God would act in the cross. None of them. Right? None of them. Wonderful stuff. And it's not accidental. Next slide. Right? Now, I picked that image to try and capture this sense of, what folly looks like. Now, you can see what's coming, can't you, friends? If we were saved by something as weak and foolish on the cross, whatever makes us think that continuing on in the Christian life means looking bigger and better than Lady Gaga. If we were saved by something as weak as the cross, whatever makes us think we're going to win the world by looking as powerful as anybody else. Right? Because what that stuff does is play exactly into what we're seeing tearing our world apart right now. And Paul's not going to have a part of that, right? No, right? God has made foolish the wisdom of this world. That was his plan, right? Next slide. I know we're ripping through this, but it was the wisdom of God that God decided we could not find him through our own wisdom. Now, just imagine what that would be like, right? Suppose it was true that you only got to know God depending on the number of degrees you had. Could you imagine just how arrogant someone like me could be? I've got more degrees than you, therefore I know God better than you. Can you see how utterly horrible that would be in the lives of people? And by the way, let me say, there are other people who take the opposite side. I have no training and they too can be arrogant. Right? The problem is not the training or the lack of training. The problem is the state of the heart. So God's wisdom here, right? Remember King Ahab, right? What does he do? He decides to murder Naboth so he can get his vineyard. And he thinks he can get away with it. But God sees everything, and so Elijah arrives. Ah, and what does Ahab say? Have you found me, O my enemy? And the prophet says, you betcha. Because God defends the orphan. and the widow and those who are oppressed. You see, the problem with having the knowledge of God based on my wisdom, it just feeds into that I'm better than you and I can oppress you. And I've sometimes seen theologians, not many, thank goodness, but I've seen some who think they're better than the rest of the church. You can tell that attitude because when there's something to disagree with, they don't humbly serve, they throw hand grenades. And so if I can say this, when I was the dean at Alpha Crucis, I said to my faculty, if I ever see you throw a hand grenade, you're done. We're here to serve the church, not to be arrogant, right? And can I say, and as part of it, again, it's my own agenda, but that's, you know, we Pentecostals love titles, and that worries me. So I'm not trying to blame anyone here. I appreciate you trying to do me honor. Thank you, thank you, thank you. But I know how twisted my heart can be. I just want to keep away from that stuff, right? I am your brother. And I've said that to my faculty as well. I'm not your boss. The first place I stand is your brother. We talk about stuff like that, right? None of us has anything we can boast in apart from what Christ has done. It's, you know, it's great stuff, isn't it? Right? Not how we're meant to be. And what happens then if we can find God through our own thinking? Guess who God ends up looking like? Me! What a wonderful thought. Look at Jonah, right? Creating God in his own judgmental image. So he has to go to Nineveh, doesn't really want to go there, preaches this gospel of judgment, sits up in the sun, gets kind of frustrated with getting sunburnt. God causes a plant to grow. Now Jonah's happy, waiting for destruction to come. And then God sends a worm. And the plant dies. And now Jonah is really annoyed. Right? And the last question at the end of the book is God says to Jonah, hang on a minute. Why are you so concerned about a plant here today, gone tomorrow, and you care nothing for 120,000 people and all their animals? That's how Jonah finishes. It's a book directed. It's not really about a fish. It's a book directed to people who make God in their own judgmental image. And that's the outcome. It's no surprise, friends, that some forms of holiness end up becoming demonic. And those are Jesus' own words to the Pharisees. Right? Your father, the devil. It's possible for that to happen. Right? And Paul says, no, this is about trusting, not what we think should happen, but what God actually did. And God did the cross. Right? And that, you see, it's designed to overthrow all of our self-reliance. We do not get to tell God how to do things. Because that's the problem. We still want to be the one who orders everyone else's life. Next slide, thank you. So he comes back now to their world. Next slide. So why did God do this? We've done that. Next one. Sorry, I kind of got carried away and missed it. Good. So in that world, what are Jews looking for? They're looking for signs. That's on the left-hand side. That's Marc Chagall, the Red Sea. Why do they look for signs? Because the Jews of all people are the only ones who experienced it. They've been through the Exodus. They've seen God in action. They've seen him with his mighty arm, right? So they're expecting when Messiah turns up, it's going to be exactly like that. God will kick the stuffing out of the Romans and then the Jewish people will be top dog. That's what they're expecting, right? But if they read their history, they'd realize that the Exodus did not solve the real problem of Israel's rebellion. Didn't solve that, right? And can I say, folks, it's really important. I mean, the language of power, great, don't ever lose it. But if it's not through the lens of the cross, it will become oppressive and look just like the pagan world. Because wow. That's not what changes us, okay? So the Jews are looking for signs. But their real bondage, as the prophets and Jesus knew, was the rebellion in their own hearts. Where they'd set themselves saying, well, we know better than God what things should look like. That was Isaiah 29. Israel's leaders thinking, we know better. On the one hand, the Greeks, right? They were the first ones who really thought you could explain the world just through human rationality. So they knew that God, as the highest, the most perfect, unchanging, lacking nothing, he's got to be about the good, the beautiful, and the true, right? The elite, the best. The early pagan philosophers got really upset with Christians because we cared about people who didn't have much. We cared about people who were broken and whose lives were a mess. And that happens to be me in spite of the fine clothes, right? And they would say, why would you waste your time on the wreckage of humanity? You should be focusing on the good, the beautiful, and the true. And I have to ask you, folks, it's lovely to see this congregation, but there is a message that we communicate in the way that we dress about what God values. I knew a church back in Melbourne, great church. Whenever the elders got together at a weekly meeting, they'd actually assign dress codes. So when the elders stood up, there'd be someone in a nice jacket and someone in shorts and thongs. So no matter who was in the congregation, they could go, oh, I can identify with that. Right? Isn't that thoughtful? And it's actually loving and compassionate. It's a way of saying this really is a church for everyone, and we do not judge people on the basis of their clothes or their cars or whether their houses have two doors at the front or not. What degrees they have, we don't do that kind of thing, because when we do that, that's what leads to Christ's church. And what Christ's church should really be about is the cross. And when that happens, that's going to change the way we relate to people. Okay? So that's why, next verse please, verse 23. They're looking for that, but what do we proclaim? Christ crucified. Christ crucified. Now, the first time I heard this, and some of you might know Gordon Fee, he was my teacher. He taught me 1 Corinthians, and his teaching on this passage just changed my life. And Gordon, I salute you. A lot of this stuff came from him. He was actually probably the first Pentecostal ever to get a truly bona fide PhD and be a world-recognized scholar. And he opened the way for lesser people like me to follow in his footsteps, you know, as we can. But just first man who taught me you could love being a scholar and weep in class. And just you've no idea what a liberation that was. Crucified, it's almost impossible for us to understand what this would have meant in the ancient world. Right? We're in a world full of crosses. Remember Saving Private Ryan? Remember that movie? Very powerful movie. How does it begin? In a graveyard, a cemetery, and they're all crosses. You have any idea how that's just totally not the ancient world that would be? This is such a disgusting thing that we don't have a single description of a crucifixion in all of our ancient literature. Not a single description. It happened only to two kinds of non-people. Runaway slaves who got above themselves, and part of the sadistic fun was to raise them up so you could see how far they'd fallen in their ignominy and agony as they just hung out there, right? So when you read the language in the New Testament of Christ being lifted up, don't miss the profound irony, because they're actually lifting up people who got above themselves in a way of absolutely humiliating them. I don't mean to go through all of this, but there's no toilet breaks on a cross. And they're usually not that high, so dogs and wild, you can just imagine what it's like, okay? It's not a pleasant thing. And then insurrectionists, folks who try to free themselves from Rome. You can understand them from a Jewish point of view, right? They're looking for this great messianic king. That's why the Romans would often crucify Jewish pretenders, messianic pretenders, on the Passover. Because Passover, that's when they had their first deliverance. That's when they're expecting their second. And the Romans say, see, this is what we do to your Jewish kings. Right? So Israel's leadership know exactly what they're doing when they try to get Jesus crucified on Passover. And so does Jesus when he plans for that to happen. You got that? He plans to die on Passover. Now he's telling us something about what true power and true wisdom look like. Right? So, terrible scandal for them, right? So, over the next slide. This is a piece of graffiti. You might be surprised to learn that modern cities did not invent graffiti, little writings. It seems that the temptation to write on other people's walls has been with humanity for a very long time, right? Okay. And what does this look like? The Greek text says, Alexamenos sebeteteon, right? Alexamenos worships his god. And you've got a donkey-headed man on a what? Who do you think that's referring to? That's right, the guy that you and I are now singing to as Lord. That's a piece of graffiti that tells you what the Greeks think of these early Christians. Because the cross is just ignominious. It's only for non-persons. Right? You see, you understand why we're following a God like this. So let's have done with posturing and trying to impress people by being cool. Right? All that kind of stuff born of our insecurity and our arrogance, and all it does is bring division. Right? We don't do that kind of thing. We don't do bigger and better than Lady Gaga. I'm not criticizing her. That's just not who we are. Because the whole of the world has been transformed. This is the way God has revealed his power. And how powerful is it? Because what it does is just remove all that stuff that we would normally divide over. And we realize actually the ground is level, as people would say, around the cross. I tried to explain this once at a conference to a group of pastors, and because just to help people get the offense. And I said, guys, look, it's a little bit as though, well, like Jesus died of AIDS. And the room went silent, and this guy yelled out from up the back. He said, "That's absolutely wrong. AIDS is God's judgment." Right? And I thought, you know, you got it right, because that's exactly how Paul thought of Jesus on the cross. It was God's judgment, and he can show you the scripture. And then we can talk more about that. It was God's judgment, but it was our sin and not his. Right? So I want to say this, can I, folks? Paul has to preach this gospel. Right? So next slide, please. But to those who are called, and Jews and Greeks, you see that? Breaking down that division. No longer to those who were called, we now see this as Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. And can I say, if we don't preach the scandal to the called, they will not be saved. Got that? That's what Paul understands. That's why it comes at the very front of this letter. It's the foundation of everything. We can never sort out the stuff we have to sort out if we don't start here and realize that all of that stuff about what we think is powerful and what all of that, that's no longer the world we live in. We're doing something very, very different. Right? Okay. Paul wants to say to them, if they keep behaving according to the old standards, competition, comparison, fighting over power and status, judging by the same standards, who's the most intelligent, who's the most beautiful, who's the coolest, who has the biggest cars, biggest churches, the best worship bands, the best speakers. Right? What's that all about? Making me feel better about myself. And apparently I can only do it by making someone else feel less. You seen the movie Crazy Rich Christians? No, it's an allusion to... So what's going on here, as we come to the end of all of this, is the cross actually turns out to be God's judgment on all of our pretensions. You see, because everyone's made in God's image, every time I try to make myself look better than someone else, I'm actually dissing God. Wow. Not that? That's why later on when Paul talks about worship in the church, he says to the men, you keep those head coverings off, because the head covering marked elite men over against others. You don't bring those divisions into the church. Right? It's not what this community is about. The cross is God's judgment on all of our pretensions. And yes, we all stand condemned. Now, I know we don't like to use that word of ourselves. Don't judge me. Of course, we're happy to do that to other people, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or the Christchurch terrorist. The fact is, we all make judgments about other people all the time. And exactly on these kinds of bases. And I'm right there in the front row. We have two choices. Either God is wrong or I'm wrong. And how very hard it is for us to admit the latter. Right? The fact is, none of the stuff that we dreamed up, neither the Jews' signs nor the Greeks' wisdom, ever actually brought reconciliation and peace to the world. I think it was Luther who talked about us being kind of irrevocably warped, so curved in upon ourselves that we cannot admit that we are fundamentally wrong. Now, there's something cool about admitting to little wrongnesses. That's called humility, right? To actually talk about fundamental wrongness at my very core, that's a sign of insanity. And we have places for people like that. Because deep down, we're all committed to the fact that we are fundamentally right. And we spend our entire lives trying to rearrange the world around that fact to prove it. Gordon Fee talked about this once. He was saying that when it's been a particularly hot day, the kids were tired, they've been crabby with each other, Dad had had enough, and he gave them the final one. Next time you guys are in trouble, well, you know, kids being little sinners that they are, there's another blue, and Dad, in all his sensitivity, grace and compassion, comes booming through the door. All right, who started it? And he did, she did, right? It's the way of the family. Adam and Eve. She did. The woman you gave me. She says, no, it's the serpent, right? That's what we do. And the fact is, actually, God says, no, Rick, you did it. The buck stops with you, mate. You're responsible. You are guilty of Jesus' death, and there's no outs. And it gets worse. There's nothing you can do about it. One of the toughest things for us to do is, okay, God save me. What can I do to show God he made a good decision? There's got to be something I can do to prove to him that I was actually a good choice. Right? And you can't. Next slide, coming to the end. God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom. His weakness is stronger than human strength, because there comes a time, right, when we see this, that a life change. What is God going to do with a whole bunch of rebels who are just desperate to save their identity somehow? What's he going to do? Right? Well, we know what we would do. There are two options, the machine gun and Pavlova. You got to deal with intransigent rebels. What do you do? Well, you line them up, 1, 2, 3, 4, and shoot all the fours, and 1, 2, 3 will obey. No relationship, just terror. Or you offer them Pavlova and they will follow you anywhere. But neither of those options actually deal with the problem. So what does God do? He comes among us in nappies. And not even to a great village, not a great town, just to a village, ordinary peasant village. And he lives out this life, right on this planet, this tiny speck of dust. And he does it in experiencing all of our suffering, everything we go through, he goes through, and does it so much better than we could ever imagine. And he tells us we can do it better too. And what do? You see, we like to kid ourselves, don't we, that we're really on the side of the good deep down. But we're not. Because when we saw the good, what do? How did we respond? In one awful moment, we vented all of our pent-up rage against him and threw him up on a cross and said, out of our lives. And spat the words Messiah in his broken and bleeding face. And what's even more terrible and scandalous, he actually let us do it. Now, some of us, red-blooded sense of justice, boiling over, how can they do this to such a guy, right? Shake their puny fist at him. Who do they think they are? And we start to say, Jesus, come on. Well, do something. Don't just hang there. At least for once, act like a God and deal with these people. And he doesn't. He just hangs there and forgives them. And what's our response? Die then. Who needs a God like you? Good riddance. Can't even take care of himself. I know what God is like, and God is not like that. But that's not the truth. And final story. I have gone over a bit. I do apologize. Gordon used to talk about a professor at the school I studied at, Addison Leach, who was once the president of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. They lived in a nice part of town, vacant block next to the house. The kids would play. And one day, a little guy called Dave was mucking around with his air rifle and broke this beautiful bay window in the Leach's house. As soon as he saw what he'd done, he went flying home as fast as he could, ran upstairs, hid in his bedroom, right, and just waiting in terror for the phone to ring. Okay? And it does, and he dies, but it turns out to be for his sister, right? Real relief, okay? Goes down for dinner, doesn't eat. Mum says, are you okay? Oh, I'm fine. Nothing's fine. What are you talking about? Goes to bed, absolutely awful day. What's the problem? He knows he needs judgment. He just can't face it. Next day, he's out in the street playing baseball. David's still feeling a bit uneasy. Out of the corner of his eye, he sees Dr. Leach. As soon as he sees, runs away, right? Hides in his house. So he can't come out when Dr. Leach is around. Okay? One day, as time goes on, he gets a bit, you know, doesn't pay as much attention. And Dr. Leach actually comes up and says, David, we can't continue to live like this. David turns around in horror, right? And Dr. Leach says, listen, you know, can we just sort this out? And David yells at him, no, and runs off. I think that's us. And then one day the miracle occurs. The boys are playing and Dr. Leach turns the corner on his way home and David sees him. And again he drops everything, but this time he runs up to Dr. Leach and offers to take his briefcase. And they become friends. They become firm friends. And now I tell you, of course, that Dr. Leach and his wife lost their only son in Korea and David kind of took over that role. So I just want to say to you folks, that's what the wisdom of the cross is about. God's great love for us. And if you've only heard this gospel for the first time, you need to know it's for you. That's what Jesus died for. You can come to him. And if you're like me and you've been following him for a while and you fall into this other stuff, then now's a good time to get prayed for too. Okay. So I don't know how you do this, but maybe I can just say, it's a bit of quiet something or other. I don't intend to do this a lot. I'll do it now. Just close your eyes, and if you'd like prayer, maybe just stand up where you are. People around you can lay hands on you. No pressure, only going to do it once. But if you're like me and you think, Lord, I really got to deal with this wisdom stuff because I get a bit arrogant, so I'm going to come down the front and join you, okay? And we're just going to stand. If you want to, eyes closed, please. So 2 minutes to stand up, and then I'll start praying. Okay? Father, we do thank you for the incredible power and wisdom of the cross. And Lord, I confess before you how often I fall into those other ways of thinking that end up leading ultimately to the terrible things we've seen in the last few days. Lord, we want to be yours. We want to be totally yours and be transformed by the power of your cross. Lord, I pray that through your Spirit, you'll transform my life, the life of my friends who are standing here, and for those who'd like to be standing but aren't. Invest our lives, I pray, with the powerful transforming work of your Holy Spirit, that his love, reflecting the love of Christ, might break down those middle walls of division. May this community become the safest place on earth where people can know you and be set free. And we ask this for Jesus' great glory, who loved us and gave himself for us. Amen. Thanks, folks. I did go on a bit. God bless you.